This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
How do you make the perfect world?
You watch this episode and listen to half of it.
I think we solved it.
We did it, guys.
Hey, I talked about Wheel of Time pretty early on. You mentioned Red Rising.
It's a complete episode now. And how important is uniqueness and creativity when it comes to your magic system? Because there's a lot of pressure. First off, first guest to ask us a question. Thank you. So I knew from day one, Jed, I was a number one fan. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Two to Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm your other host, Richard.
And today is one of our special days where we have a special guest. And today it is Jed Hearn, YouTube channel author. Jed Hearn, welcome to the channel.
Hi, guys. Big fans. We were talking before we were recording, trying to compare notes on how long we've been watching each other's channels and how parasocial this feels to finally be chatting with each other in person. So I'm really looking forward to the chat today.
Yeah, it is so strange because I had the most lackluster welcome for someone I've been watching for so long. Jed, I mean this in the strongest way. I love you, okay? And I've been watching your stuff for years. Jed gives a lot of great writing advice out there. So, of course, the topic of this whole podcast has to be about world building, how Jed does it, what we all think. We're going to ramble away with some world building advice that I think will be very useful for people watching because I hope to learn something today. We're students today.
We're students witnessing the master. Bump your ego up a little bit.
But we were supposed to play good backup. You forgot the whole plan.
Oh, my bad. Sorry. You know, maybe we'll teach you a few things. You know, us haven't written any books. We'll teach you, the person who has written things.
Yeah. Jed, welcome.
That's the purpose of being a critic, is talking about things you don't know.
Absolutely.
Right? Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Those who can't actually do it. Critique.
Every guest is more qualified on us, and it just keeps getting better. So, Jed, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
What an introduction. Absolute way to hype me up there. No, I'm really excited for this. I absolutely love world building. I feel like it's the thing that kind of got me into fantasy the most when I was just starting out. And it's something I'm extremely passionate about. So very keen to discuss this in some more detail.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. So I guess first off is the big question is, what do you think is the most important element when going to craft a world? What is the first thing to think about and really mull over?
I guess it depends on the emotional experience that you want your story to create. Like, I often think that the best world building is where the author knows the sort of emotions they're attempting to produce within the reader, and then they craft the world in such a way that develops that thing. So if you look at something like The Lies of Locke Lamora by Scott Lynch, for example, have you guys read The Gentleman Bastards book? Yeah, fantastic.
Don't spoil for anybody. Keep it very light.
I'll keep it light. So that's sort of set in like a fantasy version of medieval Venice. And it's this world where it's like super bright and it's colorful and it's really capricious. And there's like this sense of whimsy to, you know, how the city is structured and everything. But there's also like dark undertones, and you can very easily go from like some parade where everyone's wearing these like carnival masks to you go into another alley and, you know, you get your like throat ripped open and your purse is stolen from you or something like that. And it's the perfect metaphor for the emotional experience that you go through as a reader in that series. You know, you go through this experience of like, oh, Locke and these other characters, they're doing these fun heists, they're doing these like wild adventures, and, you know, they're conning people in these really clever and witty ways. But then there's also moments of like real darkness within those series, within those books as well. And so that's a good example of like the world as like a way to kind of create different emotional experiences within the author, within the reader. And then if you look at another good example is something like The First Law by Joe Abercrombie. I think he often gets criticized, and I've said it in the past that, you know, the world building of The First Law is maybe not super intricate or super original, but I actually think it's very effective because that story is all about kind of like the grittiness and the corruption and the darkness that lies within the human heart, I suppose. And the world is one where you really see that grittiness and that darkness kind of manifest through the ways in which, you know, wars are fought and even in through how some of the cities are designed. And that gets even more so in his Age of Madness trilogy as well, where it's kind of this fantasy world that's industrializing. And it's just like a world where you really feel the soot like staining your lungs, and you see the smoke coming out of the chimneys as they're rising over Adwa. And it's just like a really good example of using that world building to kind of produce emotion within you. So that's probably one of the ways where I would be thinking about it from a starting basis. What about you guys? Like, how do you feel like is the best way for you to kind of experience world building in a fantasy story? Like, what do you think it is doing for you as a reader?
First off, first guest to ask us a question. Thank you. So I knew from day one, Jed, I was a number one fan. Thank you, Jed. do you want to go on that? Or I could jump in first.
Because you go first.
I'm excited. Okay. This is my guy. Okay. So I think the thing you're talking about there, I think goes under the umbrella of tone. Generally, right, of a great sure. tone with a book and getting across, whether it's more grim dark, whether it's your Discworld's more absurd and whimsical, getting across a good tone. So whenever you think of that world, you go, that's the kind of feeling you get, that emotion you're talking about evoking. And that's a great part about worlds I personally love. And I think that's one key element of the world building. And the one to throw under that is besides tone, I think this is the most important part. And Jed, I'm super curious. Rich, okay, I'll ask you as well. We'll ping pong. I'll go Rich and then we'll go to Jed. Okay, we'll do a little bit of that. But I think the most key element to every world ever that you need to do is make sure that your character isn't the only one living in that world. Like when your characters remove, when we're no longer following the protagonist, the world still functions. Everything's going on. I don't need to be following Kaladin from Stormblessed or watching Frodo or looking at Frodo and Sam. I just know Middle Earth is existing outside that. Roshar is existing outside that, regardless if I'm following this character. That's how real it is, that the world is a character itself. That's how you get me going. And we're going to go through like what makes that good, because there's history, culture, geography, flora, fauna. There's so much to go into with worlds of what can make a reader really suspend their disbelief, because that's what it's trying to do. Suspend your disbelief.
To carry that forward to that exact point is, for me, it's history. So I love a world where, and what this is the thing that, if the goal of world building is to get you immersed into it and to make you forget about reality for a time and to convince you that this fictional world is real on the page. For me, it's a history and the culture, and more especially the connection between the two, that you can directly see like, oh, this culture's history has affected them even to today. And you can see, you could start to see, not even, you don't have to see it all, but you could see glimpses. It's the reason why. So why does Middle Earth work so well? Because you can see a vast history. And even if you don't get all the pieces, you can see the change, and that Middle Earth has not always been the same. It has evolved over time. So this moment isn't alone. And so that's, I think, a big part of it, where if I read a world where there's not much history to it, it's just a snapshot. I can't picture what this place is outside of this book in time, it doesn't immerse me as well. And so that's a big part of it for me when I'm looking at a book. That's the reason why Wheel of Time is one of my favorite worlds. It's specifically the connection between history and the cultures and how those cultures have changed over time through different historical moments. So I know the books that I'm reading are not, it's not the beginning, it's not the end of the world. It is a small fraction of the entire story of this fictional place.
Great point. Yeah, Jeb, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think you guys have taught me a bit there, actually. I never thought about world building in the sense of it works really well when you can feel it functioning when your character isn't there, to your point, Austin, which I really like. And I think as I was just reflecting on that, all of my favorite fantasy worlds, they are ones where I do feel like they are very deeply connected to the main characters and to the characters' arcs that kind of go through them. But there is also the sense of, wow, I would love to go into that world and explore around. Or, you know, maybe not in some worlds. Like, I wouldn't necessarily want to go into Westeros and be like, hey, King's Landing, let's check that out and see what's going on around here or whatever. But, you know, there is this sense that it would be fascinating to explore all these other angles, and that, like, we're walking through a city and we're going down this one street, but I can see all these other streets going off from it. I can see these entrances to buildings going off from it. And I know that I could walk into those buildings and I could walk into those streets, and I wouldn't just feel like I'm behind the facade of some movie set or something like that.
Right.
And then to your point, Richard, I think, like, you're absolutely correct with the sense of history there. Like, I was recently traveling a lot around Morocco and Spain for the last couple of months. And I reflected on the fact that, like, when I am traveling in these other places, one thing that does make them feel really interesting, particularly coming from Perth, where most of the buildings where I live, you know, if we have a building that's like 50 years old here, it's considered like a really rare old heritage building or something like that. And then you go to Morocco and it's like, oh yeah, like this, you know, Casbah has been here for 800 years. It's this fortress in the side of a mountain, and now there's no one that lives there anymore. And there's a couple of families that sort of, you know, maybe live in these dwellings, and it's mostly a tourist thing or whatever. And that's so fascinating, right? That sense of like this deep history and deep lore. And you start to imagine all the possible stories that could have taken place in this thing up until this point in time. And it does make your character feel like they are sort of, it almost feels like good world building makes your character feel insignificant, right? Like if your character feels too significant, and then they're overpowering the world around them, it almost makes the world building feel flat. But if the world is so like richly developed and complex and has this long sense of history and backstory to it, then it's like your character is just this little speck here. And yeah, I don't know what that says about like the way we humans see ourselves or whatever, but
right.
I think that is an interesting aspect of it for sure.
It's, I think the best part about really good world building is it's a way an author is almost able to not actually tell you more stories, but imply more stories.
Ooh,
it's the implication of more stories than what you're currently reading. So the best book is, yeah, you've read one book, but really in your mind, you have that story. And also there's a story unknown about this fictional king that was there, and you know that they were such an influential figure, and they pop up a couple different times of how they've fundamentally shaped the kingdom. Of this used to be one large kingdom, and now it's broken into five sections because this king destroyed it.
Yes.
Whatever happened, like, you know there's a story there, and it's in your head too. And that's what makes it feel so much bigger.
The author's teasing you because they're showing, hey, I'm telling you this story, but I have so many more in my pocket.
Big reason on why I love Discworld so much is he can have his cake and eat it too, because each story, it's almost like this, the whole world is there. And when I'm talking about implied stories, Terry Pratchett just gives them to you. There's all of these little things happening, going on. And yeah, they're implied stories in that one moment. And then he actually gives you that story. Mm-hmm. You see when you're reading The Wizards, the first couple of books, you're going, death is a figure. And death,
for those listening, these are not spoilers. This is very broad.
Death's got his own thing going on. And he's like, hey, he's kind of doesn't like this one wizard, and he's kind of annoyed with him. He's clearly
little asides,
but clearly Death has something else going on. He's his own character fulfilled. And you go, oh, that's really interesting, and that's an implied story. And then we actually get a story with him, and it's wonderful.
In later books,
that's what it's personally. I think my favorite world, and argue my favorite series and author. I love Discworld. It's
That whole point you're making, Jed, of, I like that, Rich, because you're saying that the more significant the world is, does it diminish the character in some ways? Yeah. Because immediately when I said that, I went, I care more about Middle Earth than I do Frodo, you know, but then it's a strange point. The characters I really love and the world around them is cool and neat, but I think about the characters more.
Oh, that was the best part about your point on Lysa Locke Lamora. One of the reasons I really like the story is because, yes, it's a fantasy world, but the world building is done in such a way that you're supposed to feel like Locke and his friends are small. Mm. It makes it feel like, I'm keeping it pretty light if I can. Like, people know it's a heist story, but the main thing is they're not the magical, like, there is magic, but Locke and his friends aren't. And so it's at an oppressive state of they're not the big dogs in the story. If magic comes in, you're done. You're out. And it makes them, it almost feels like you're watching the side characters, the background characters of a much larger world.
Right.
And it's an enjoyable feeling that you get from that series.
Oh, totally. And Jed, do you think that's to the book's detriment? Because going on that point, can you get can you have your cake and eat it too? Like you're saying with Discworld, can you do that a lot where the world's so intense and amazing and also the characters are? For me, that's Stormlight. But is that a rarity? Can you do both? And what can you do with your world to still make your character stand out?
I think that's a very good question. I think before we get to that, there's something I wanted to add to what you were saying before, which is that sense of, okay, because of the deep history that we have in this world, there's like thousands of possible stories that could be told here.
Yep.
And I think that when authors make you believe that there are thousands of stories they could be telling you, the fact that they're telling you this one story kind of implies that it's really important, right? Or that it's really meaningful. Because if it's like, hey, Middle Earth has been around for thousands of years or whatever it is, I'm telling you this particular story about like these two hobbits trying to throw this ring into a volcano. It makes you just realize, okay, well, there must be something like deeply significant and important about this story here, even if it's on kind of a subconscious level. To your point about like world building, overpowering characters, yeah, I absolutely think like that can happen. I feel like it's more a function of, so I edit like a lot of different fantasy writers' novels, and I help different writers outline their stories in some group programs that I run as well. And I feel like whenever I see that issue coming up of the world building overpowering the characters, it's less that the world is really good and therefore there's not enough room for the reader to connect with the characters. It's more that the author has just spent 90% of their time on the world building and they've only spent 10% of their time on the characters. And so it's more a function of like your focus as a writer and where you put the energy. I don't necessarily think that great world building is like an antithesis to, you know, really well-developed and complex characters. I suppose a counterexample is, again, if you look at someone like Joe Abercrombie, you know, he's someone where most people would say like, okay, the world building here is sort of, he picks a relatively standardized setting, and that comfort with the setting you have then allows him to kind of go deeper with the characters. But I think that's a criticism that for me like was totally addressed when I read the Age of Madness trilogy, where you do have that sense of, okay, the world of this industrializing nation is actually incredibly developed and it has synthesis with the characters here. So I think when you do it right, like the more that you develop, and this is something I was telling a couple of my students a few weeks ago, I almost see like the three points of storytelling, if you like, as plot, world building, and characters. And I almost see these different three points as like these cups, right? Like, got an empty water glass over here. Here's a prop I prepared earlier. And if you imagine these cups next to each other, the more you fill up one cup, eventually it reaches a point where it's going to start spilling over into the cups around it. And I kind of feel like whenever I'm writing a story, it's the same way. The more I fill up my world building cup, eventually it reaches a point where it just starts to spill over into my plot cup and it starts giving me ideas for action scenes or set pieces or these twists that could come. And it starts spilling over into my character cup. I start thinking, well, okay, you've got this, you know, this setting where, you know, it's this disc that's floating in space, like in, where is it? In Across the Broken Stars or something. You've got these discs that are floating in space and they were, you know, allegedly created by these angels long and long ago. What is that going to do to the psyche of people who are now living on the remnants of these things? You know, are they going to be having a like worshiping relationship to those angels? Are they going to have a hostile relationship to them? Like, what's their psyche going to be like and the psychological impact of that world building? So generally speaking, I feel like the more you develop any one of those three aspects of your story, the more it benefits everything else. I'd be curious. What do you guys think on that?
My thought is a great example of this exact problem to me is most sci-fi. Or maybe not most, but I think sci-fi has the bigger problem.
No, be bold.
Use the superlatives.
Come on, it's a podcast.
Yes, this is most sci-fi has these problems.
Oh.
But
Austin trying to get Rich canceled by the sci-fi authors over here. Let's go.
But no, you read something like A Fire Upon the Deep, where the world building is top notch. Like, he clearly put so much focus into crafting this interesting sci-fi world. What is the message he is trying to say about this? That the characters do kind of fall by the wayside. And this happens a lot in my observation with sci-fi itself, that the characters are all very rarely first. It's more often that the world and the message is first before any kind of characters. And the characters are a vehicle to show you this interesting world, especially if the point of the book is to show you something about society, something about how man operates or how we function as people. And having a very strong, unique character would kind of get in the way of that. Something like a Neuromancer, which is that cyberpunk feel, that you are supposed to get a feeling of hopelessness and the unending change in that society. You're just a cog in the machine. Well, if you had a very unique character that's sticking out and sticking it to the system, they wouldn't be a cog in the machine. And so to do that story, you have to follow someone that's not as...
Some are purposefully not having characters with an insane arc that you want to fall in love with and going for different things. Yeah, great.
So, and that's kind of my point of the character's now more of a vehicle, which not giving a lot, giving them a lot of intrigue. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what you think about that, Jed. Is that kind of an inevitability? Is that a negative? Should authors always strive to make their characters dynamic and interesting in and of itself, or is there a place for a world-focused book where the characters are deliberately flat, like they're just a plot device or a vehicle for the story?
I think it absolutely depends on what your goal is as a writer. I think, oftentimes when you think about these different aspects of writing, like characters or world-building or plot or whatever, there's this sense that you have to maximize all of these things, and you have to be doing all of these things at a 10 out of 10 level. And realistically, every aspect of story is just a tool. Characterization is a tool, which sounds weird to say, but it's if the point of my story, and I'll take something like Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky, for example. So it's for people who aren't familiar with it, humans tried to terraform this other planet out in space. It failed, and they accidentally populated it with a bunch of spiders and then infected them with a virus that made them super intelligent. Now the spiders are basically building their own civilization there. Many hundreds, or I think even thousands of years later, humans or the remnants of humanity are now coming back into contact with this super intelligent spider world. And it's a story where I don't really connect with the characters hugely. There are definitely some emotional moments where you're holy crap, this character has been put into suspended animation and taken out and put into suspended animation, and he's gone through 1,000 years in cryo sleep, and this society on the ship around him has worshipped him, then said he was the devil, then worshipped him again, and now he's born and people don't even know who he is. So there's definitely characters you connect with, but I also couldn't tell you the name of that character, for example, not in the same way that I could have an instantly memorable character like Kaladin from the Stormlight Archive or something like that. So there's definitely stories where I think the author intentionally knows that characterization and strong characterization may take away from their goal with the narrative. Just as there are stories where world building is maybe not that useful to what you're trying to do. Maybe you do actually want to have a story where you are not distracting readers with rebuilding society from scratch and coming up with all these interesting magic systems and all these rules. And you are actually just wanting to tell a story that's far more internally focused on one character's struggles with his son or something like that.
A great sci-fi example, that's All Systems Red with Martha Wells. If you've read, it's just complete.
Yeah, good example. I've only read the first Murderbot book. But yeah, that's a good example, right? Where it's the main focus there is on Murderbot's personality and her their unique sense of voice and everything.
To give that another example, I think Rage of Dragons really falls into that category as well, where the story, it's a revenge story with a single POV where the character just has tunnel vision on their revenge and seeing how that affects them. So yes, there is a rich, interesting world and you do get little snippets, but you almost deliberately are blind to a lot of things. There's clearly a lot of stuff going on that you're not seeing because the character is ignoring all of these big things that are going on. It's like, nope, focusing on just my revenge. And so you as the reader kind of feel oddly pigeonholed into the story. Mm. So the world building, sure, it suffers in that sense because you don't really see all of it and you don't get attached and don't get a lot of that mysticism that you want from a world building, but it really helps develop the character's point of view.
Yeah, you can, that whole analogy you used, Jed, with the cup and spilling over into your plot, into your characters, maybe there's a case where for a lot of your sci-fis, because Rich, your response to that is just going, hey, sometimes just worlds are, that's all they really care about. And then they just have to insert character to make it make sense. So Fire Upon the Deep, great example. But to give a more well-known example, for 2001, A Space Odyssey, is, if anyone's seen the film, not going to spoil anything crazy, but there's no characters, really. There's zip for the characters, and the plot exists just to promote the message and the themes and the cinematography of it. Just be supposed to be visually stunning, and you're supposed to think at the end about these no-name characters that literally don't matter. So when you have a director or we have an author that's just so focused on just one or two things they want to get across and to emphasize whatever that cup is, maybe that, to continue with your analogy, Jed, you can have a world-building cup that just spills into more world-building cups because that's that's what they care about. Whereas I think
they knocked the other cups off the table.
They don't care about those cups.
I don't need these. Get rid of them.
Yeah. Because with you, and that's a great analogy to look at for a well-rounded book, and especially you're talking to new writers. And I think it's very difficult for a fresh writer writing their indie book to go, okay, I'm going to create the new Middle Earth, where it's a lot easier to go with the advice of you should get a well-rounded world, characters, and plot. And to do that, if you focus on one really well, the others will be lifted up with that, generally speaking, because it's, you want to be a good, well-rounded writer. Then you could figure out, maybe narrow more into what your thing is. Because I don't know about you guys, but when you pick up any book, you can almost by the second chapter tell what the author's main goal was, whether it was characters or plot or world. You can kind of go and for the first chapter, you know, okay, they wanted to tell the story because they thought of this character first, or they wanted to tell this story because they wanted to get me into this world. And you can usually pick up on that and then adjust your expectations from there. Do you guys ever get that where you just pick up, you kind of know from the get-go?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some concepts where like you read it and go, yeah, the guy came up with this cool concept, and that's all he cared. That's all he cared about. So you want that?
Yeah, I'd never thought about that approach before, but you're absolutely right. And I was just trying to think through the books I've published and trying to figure out which one it was for me. I feel like it's almost a little arms race between writers and readers here, where it's like you probably don't necessarily want your reader to figure it out that quickly. Like, I don't know, because there's a lot of stories where it's like, I begin by saying, oh, okay, I want to tell, like, for example, the Thunder Heist. You can probably guess it's like about a heist, right? I'm trying to genuinely remember, like, if it started with me thinking, I want to tell a heist. I actually think this one started with like a magic system, which then led to a character.
Huh.
And then I got rid of the magic system, kind of, and then set it in a different world. And then I was like, oh, I want to tell a heist on top of that. But I think if you like read the first opening pages of it, you probably are like, oh, well, this is like very focused on plot here. You know, like it starts with this kind of action scene of the main character about to be executed in this this prison ship. And then it kind of just goes from there and it's pretty fast paced with not really any breaks. But it's weird. It's like, yeah, I actually started in a totally different place for that. But you're right. Like the final book, I do think it is, you could make the argument, it is a very like plot driven story. It's like, we've got to steal this thing. And we've got like this limited timeline to do it. Like, let's go and get this thing. So you probably do feel that sense of plot urgency when you pick it up. That's interesting though. I never thought about that frame of like, yeah, you can tell within the first couple of pages what the author was trying here.
Yeah. I mean, there is something, at least I'm noticing it now, when you read a lot of books and more than the average person, and you're reading at just a pace that you start reading similar books in the same genre, you start to develop some pattern recognition that no one else should reasonably able to see. Like it's unreasonable. Like I want to share this because I've shared this with all the time, but I wanted to get your take on it and hear your opinion on it. It's
okay.
a pattern that I've seen that annoys me now. It's just
oh, here we go again.
I know. I know. But I read this with Locke Lamora, with Mistborn, with Rage of Dragons, with all these different fantasy series. When the author starts explaining the plan, and they explain the full plan, it doesn't work. The plan doesn't work. It goes awry. Well. But if they start explaining the plan, and then it ends the chapter before the full explanation goes through, I know the plan is going to work.
It goes perfectly. Yes.
Red Rising was the book that discovered this for me, because it happened like back to back of like, oh, okay. Full, like, didn't explain the plan, everything worked. And then immediately after that, hey, I'm going to fully explain the plan. And then it didn't work and it went off the rails.
Yes.
I just had to ask your thoughts about, is that an unreasonable expectation of books? Is that just me being picky? Or is that a real thing to be concerned about that authors should be, like, taking note of? Or am I just crazy?
Please tell me he's crazy.
I think it comes down... No, you're absolutely right. Like, that pattern definitely exists. And I think I have done it before. I think it really just comes down to, like, everyone is reasoning from the same first principles here about what creates conflict and tension in a story. You know, like, if I'm telling my readers, hey, here's the plan, you know, I'm going to go to Richard and Austin's house and I'm going to distract them by doing a podcast. And then while they're distracted, like, my friend's going to sneak into their kitchen and steal their toaster or something like that.
There were footsteps upstairs. That was our roommate.
We do have a nice toaster.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Okay, now I've got some more intel for when I actually do my heist. But, you know, if that goes exactly to plan, then there's a real element of redundancy here, right? Where it's like, oh, well, we could have just seen it happening. And so I think everyone's sort of reasoning from the first principle of, okay, well, if I tell the whole plan, something has to go wrong. If I don't tell the whole plan, then, like, there's no redundancy and I can actually show you how clever my characters are or whatever. I suppose interesting twists on this are when you tell the whole plan and readers think they have received the whole plan, but then things seem to go wrong when the plan is happening. And it's only at the end you realize, like, oh, that actually was, like, how it was supposed to kind of pan out here. So it's almost like a double reversal, if that makes sense. But you're right. Like, this is definitely a big trope of the heist genre in particular. And, you know, it goes all the way back to, like, if you're looking at the first Mission Impossible movie, like, here's how we're going to sneak into Langley. Okay, we're going to go in this way. But then, you know, stuff starts going wrong or whatever. For me personally, as a reader, it's something that I like have no personal problem with it. Like, I like it. I think it's one of the tropes of the heist genre that I enjoy. I certainly can see how if you read a lot of stories that have that, it would feel like quite repetitive and redundant. I'm not really too sure like where the workaround would be there. I suppose it would just be you don't tell the plan and you just like go straight into them executing the thing. But then you'd kind of think, oh, well, it feels weird that we didn't see the scene that was leading up to this very pivotal moment in the story.
Mm-hmm. To your point on being able to show the plan but not show all of the plan, I think, like, unironically, Dungeon Crawler Carl series does this really well.
How so?
Because how the structure of the world is, if you haven't read the series, for people who haven't, I've been recently obsessed with it. It's a lit RPG. I didn't think I would fall in love with a lit RPG, but I have. And whole world is apocalypse. Most people are dead. Aliens open up this dungeon on planet Earth for the remaining humans to participate in basically their intergalactic game show. It's for their live TV event and how they make money. So part of it is they're going through this, you know, dungeon. They have level ups and they have all these abilities and all this, and they have to work in parties and teams. But part of it is, it's that they have to plan for these things, but also it's a game. And there are people that are controlling the game, and it's a television show.
Mm.
So they have to both plan in the game and then also to plan outside the game. If they say their plan out loud, maybe the producers of the show will manipulate things and not let them get what they want. They legitimately have to keep their plans secret even from each other. Like, they can't say it out loud, or they have a text feature, but if they do that, the game moderators will actually read their text conversations. So they have to figure out weird ways to communicate that even the game guides don't see and break the rules.
That's cool.
And so there's a legitimate level of like, okay, we have these plans, but also you know, and everyone knows that there's another secret plan that, of course, we don't get to see because the characters aren't talking about. They're doing some weird things to
So manipulate. It satisfies you because it gives a better plot reason for why they're not discussing the plan.
Where exactly.
Maybe
but,
it frustrates
but you're getting
you a bit.
Good amount of the plan.
Yeah.
You get big, broad, like, hey, here's our overarching plan. And then the plan, and we're like, and then the plan fails.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, hey, here's a sub plan that we could talk about, or here's a alternative. And then when the thing comes around of like, you know, oh, they're doing something. Like, clearly they seed it of, you know, one of the characters secretly does something and you don't understand why, but there's clearly a reason. And then later on you find out why that character did it. It's like, oh, he was hiding it from, you know, the game guys. So, mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. It's so far has avoided that exact trope for me. And maybe it's one of the reasons I'm really enjoying it. But yeah.
But so that whole plan, Jed, you mentioned this earlier on in your answer to that of talking about how giving the plan or not the plan. You're talking about conflict in a way of how conflict.
Well, conflict and tension.
What's the level of suspense exactly. Tension is this creating? Yeah.
That conflict and tension, something. So in one of your videos you have where you had, it's titled like 116 writers give you their magic systems that they created for you. And one of your consistent notes on those videos was when a world, so that whole plot element you're talking about of it, the whole point is it's to create tension with this plot and to get you to want to read on, find out does the plan work or not. But a big thing with worlds is that you were judging, Jed, was when you saw a magic system or a world that had a propensity or a great chance of creating more conflict in the story, you really liked that. Because if you could think of a world or a magic system or something set up to where it can put more obstacles in your character's way, and we can talk about Sanderson's three laws of magic, for example. One of his laws, and we can go through the other two just to see what you think, Jed, because one of his laws is that limits are better than the actual powers themselves. Essentially, flaws in a magic. So I don't know if it's his first, second, or third law, but Sanderson has these three laws of magic. You both know this. I'm saying this for the audience that might not know. But he has the three laws of magic, and how Sanderson does his magic systems is one of them is the limits themselves are way greater than the actual powers. And a part of that is because it creates this conflict, the tension. It creates cool scenarios where, Jed, I'm sure with your stories and stories that you, when writers are coming to you for advice, you see a world and the more interesting thing is, wait, what? Okay, let's say there was one person on your video who the more fear they had, the more fear that this person had, that emotion, the more fear, the stronger they became. So it kind of incentivized you to be more scared so that you'd have more power, whatever kind of cool situation it puts you in to
and
create
then
a...
the weird conflict of the stronger you become, you'd probably become less
afraid. Yeah, just so, this cool plot of it. Like, yeah. Are there some cool magic systems or worlds out there where just this tension point to where if your world can create cool scenarios for your characters or cool plot elements, that's always err on the side of more limits and more consequences, not just the cool factor? Or that is cool. I mean, just not the power factor.
I love limitations. I think it's like, for me, the fastest way to make a magic system more interesting is to like make it more limited. And I think like a good example here is you take something sort of generic and that's been done a lot, like a fire magic system, for example,
yep.
Where it's like, you know, you can shoot fireballs, you can kind of like, you're basically a human flamethrower. That kind of thing. Maybe you can set yourself on fire if you're feeling really spicy or something like that. Now that can be done like well, and there's obviously good examples of it, but we've also seen it done like in quite a lot of stories before. So a few years ago, well, I suppose like more than a few years ago now, it would have been back in 2018, when I was trying to like write a fire-based magic system for my book, Fires of the Dead, which is back here. I basically went through the same exercise of like, how do I develop interesting limitations here that make it feel unique? So the first one to me was like, okay, it seems like these people with fire-based magic can just like shoot infinite amounts of this stuff out and there's like no real restriction. maybe if you are putting a restriction there, it's like, oh, you get tired after using a lot of it. But to me, that wasn't that interesting.
Not enough.
So I kind of came up with this idea of like, you have to link yourself to a fire that's like in the world. And you do that through dropping some of your blood into it. So for example, we're going through a forest. There's a campfire that we've set up. I can, you know, kind of cut my finger, drop a bit of blood into that campfire. And now I have linked myself to that flame. So I can draw energy from that fire and then I can kind of shoot it out of my body. But it's sort of a, you know, bit of a no new energy can be created here situation where as I'm going to draw energy out of that campfire, it's going to drain it until the point where it is eventually extinguished. And the further I am away from that campfire, the like faster that energy drain is going to occur. So you can already see with like that one limitation, now there's far more conflict and tension and suspense in how the sorcerers or the pyromancers in this world are going to be using that fire. It's like, you've got to be strategic about like, what are you linking yourself to? Is it near you? Could someone, like, could an enemy extinguish that or put it out? Because you could have multiple people potentially linking themselves to the same.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
In flame here. And then it kind of led to like an interesting world-building detail, which was, okay, well, let's imagine you have these kind of ancient noble families that have these huge keeps. And in the basement of these keeps, they basically have these massive eternal bonfires that have been going for hundreds of years. Those bonfires are then the main source of magic for their pyromancers that belong to that house. And because I also wanted to infuse a little bit of kind of, I suppose, like death magic in here as well, I also came up with this concept that the ancestors of that family were like burned in that flame and their minds kind of occupy this like gestalt collective entity in there. And when you link yourself to that fire, you're sort of getting like a mental connection with the thousands of people that might potentially occupy it. And also the only way you can really become a pyromancer is you have to burn yourself in one of these source flames that has all these ancestral minds in it. And whichever part of your body has the burn scars is where you can shoot out the fire. So there's a character in Fires of the Dead, Marigan, who you kind of know that she's a little bit unhinged because pretty much like all of her forearms on like both hands and her hands themselves are like horribly scarred from connecting herself to a source flame back in the day. Most pyromancers, you know, they would just allow a small part of their hand to potentially be scarred. And that's enough for them to kind of shoot out their flames. Marigan wanted more power than that. So as a result, she has basically allowed herself to become even more disfigured by this thing. And then, you know, kind of throwing a final, you know, another type of limitation in there as well. I came up with the idea that once all of your source fires are extinguished, so maybe you've connected yourself to that ancestral fire from some noble family, And then maybe you've connected yourself to like three or four other fires around a particular city. But then let's say those three or four other fires, they all get extinguished, and the source flame where the ancestral minds are in, they all get extinguished as well. Once all your sort of connected fires are extinguished, you die. So it basically creates like this big consequence there as well, where it's like, if I'm allying myself with this particular noble house in order to connect to their fire and to become a pyromancer, I have to be like pretty confident that they're going to endure for a long time. Because if something happens to their castle, you know, if something gets destroyed there or another noble family moves against it, like I could be on the other side of the world, not knowing anything about the conflict that's going on here, and then just instantly die. Like I've had, you know, some heart attack or something like that. And all those limitations, you know, I don't feel like I've read something that kind of does, you know, that particular magic system where there's all these different things interacting in this way. And the sort of climax of the story is something where the characters use all these different rules in an emergent way to solve the particular conflict of the story without giving anything away here. It's an ending where it's like, it's trying to hit that kind of surprising yet inevitable, you know, sweet spot where it's like, oh, wow, like I didn't expect them to be able to do that, but it makes perfect sense now that I think back at all the rules that you set up beforehand. And that's only really something you can do when you build limitations into your magic. I feel like when the magic can just do everything, it's you actually get like less pathways to solving different plot problems or coming up with different scenes in your story.
That is great for two reasons. The one being that that's a great magic system setup because I like the stakes it puts. So it does the conflict portion and it creates limits. It puts obstacles in your character's way for so many plot elements.
It immediately implies a lot of stories.
A ton. So now I'm fascinated like, oh, what kind of character situation do you have? And the second greatest part is you are such a great marketer. You just plug your books in there. You have them in the back. It's so good.
Marketing.
That I, Rich, why don't you just plug our thing real quick?
Oh.
Just do it.
I love this.
Hey, you want to support us? Join our Patreon where you can talk like this with us about books.
We have a book club every month. So join us and then go support Jed. And
we were feeling inadequate. Jed was doing such a good job supporting himself. We need to catch up.
As you got the merch on, the advertising, it's great.
That is true. Oh, yeah,
We will have all Jed's books in the link in the description below, of course, and whatever stuff he wants to put us down there at the end of the video, but we're not even close to the end, so hold on. Hold your horses.
We're just getting done.
We're taking all Jed's time. So with the part that you said there, I want to touch on, and this is, I'm so curious what you both think, where you said, I tried to quote it down when you were talking. I tried to type it as fast as I could, but you said, I don't feel like I've seen something done like that when you're talking about your magic system. And how important is uniqueness and creativity when it comes to your magic system? Because there's a lot of pressure that new authors feel when they're going to create a magic system. I've seen elementals done 100,000 times. How do I make it different? And how much pressure should you put on yourself of how different your magic system, your world should be?
I personally think it's not as important. I think for newer authors, it should at least have a twist. There should be a little something. It doesn't have to be completely new, but something new to keep you interested and to give you the, because it's the simplest way to get me to read the next page.
Jed's whole thing is that he's seen that fire elemental, but how do you make it add a little limit? Okay, draw your blood, put it in a fire. Now you can draw that adding.
I would say, Jed, your book goes, like, that's unique. I wouldn't even say that's just like, that's not a twist. That's its own thing. That's completely separate. That's really unique. I haven't really heard anything like that before. So that's further. But Jed, what do you think about that? Does a magic system need to be completely unique, or can you just do a twist? Or is it fine just going standard magic system, they yell fireball comes out.
I choose you. Wait, this is Pokemon? What?
Yeah, I think, again, it all comes down to, like, there's no shoulds in writing, ultimately, right? Like, you can have a world, you can have a story where there's, like, you know, the world building is just not a focus of the author and they're more focused on the characters and the plot. You can have a world where the world building is the main focus and the characters and the plot, you instantly forget their names as soon as you've gone through the story, but you've still had a good time because of the world building you've gone through. So I think you can kind of apply that same logic to the magic. I think having seen like a lot of different magic systems, not just in that contest where I think it was like 116 riders sent in their magic. There were quite a few more as well that like actually didn't complete all the requirements of the application. So that I didn't feature their video in the final one. But, you know, all those riders I saw there, all of the riders I've sort of worked with over the years as well. I think for me personally, like uniqueness is huge. Which of course, like the more you read becomes more of a challenge to find that. I definitely think it's the kind of thing where like it's really hard to write great characters. I would say it's slightly easier to structure your plot because there's more of a science to it. When it comes to things like your world building and your magic, I actually feel like that's the thing that for most fantasy writers comes the most easily and most naturally to you. And so I think that you should challenge yourself as much as possible to try to write stuff that is unique. If your goal is to, you know, you want your readers to go through your story and be like, wow, that was a cool magic system. Again, that might not be your goal. Your focus may be more on characters. And I've certainly written some books where it's like, there's no magic or the magic takes a minimal background role because I did want to focus more on the characters and the plot. But I think if you are going to write a magic system, it's just fun to try to push yourself to make it as unique as possible. And it's also like not that hard to make it unique in the sense of like with the pyromancy magic system there, it's literally just me taking a very common thing and then like stepping down through two or three layers of limitations or rules or whatever. And once you've done that, you've already diverged like so far from what all the other magic systems out there could be. It's kind of like, you know, if you have like a pack of cards, the different orders that those could be arranged in, I think is like more than the number of atoms in the universe or something crazy like that. Cause you know, you've got 52 cards, you could arrange them in any order. And so I think it's mostly just a case of like applying just a few different interesting limitations or, you know, rules or restrictions to it. And you will end up in a place that feels like pretty, you know, interesting and unique as well. And oftentimes you can take a magic system which you may have seen done before, but when you filter it through like your unique characters' perceptions and traits and personalities and everything, like you do end up with something that's pretty unique. So to answer your question, I know that was a long response to it. I would say like for me, I love to see unique magic systems and it is a big thing that will make me fall in love with a story. Is it essential for a great fantasy novel? No, not at all.
That 52 card analogy is perfect example because do you want to say something on that first? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Because I'm just going to go on that whole point of there being so many options that you have. Because the first thing when you say, oh, you have to create something completely new and inventive, it's a daunting task at first when you hear that. But then going the one layer of just saying, hey, instead of copying this, just use it for inspiration and just do one little thing. Just do one little change that can make it unique in and of itself. Because something that first came to mind for me is Sword of Kaigan. And for those that haven't read, I'm not spoiling, just giving you the basic magic system, is elemental magic, just like Avatar the Last Airbender. Avatar the Last Airbender is earth, water, air, fire. You can bend the elements. Same thing with Sword of Kaigan. The one layer deeper is it is, I won't give spoilers for the book other than it uses that in a darker, more extreme sense of so powerful are these magic users that in order to give birth to another magic user, that's elemental magic, you have to be a strong enough user yourself, and it creates these more intense plot lines because it doesn't change the magic system crazily. They do cool things with these ice monsters.
But it gives some great limitations for the character.
Exactly.
Moments.
It goes what the one layer. It's same thing. Same magic system, does same cool stuff, but then adds that. And yeah, it's the same thing, but adds new enough to where I can distinguish the two magic systems.
You know, I think to add on to it, and this is more maybe a cynical take, but a good reason why you should make a more unique magic system and not say focus so much on the character itself is if you're a new author and let's say you're self-publishing author and you're just trying to get a new reader, no one knows you, but you want them to read your book. You gotta hook them in first couple chapters, trying to hook a person into a character, and like you focus really hard on a wonderful character journey. Well, are they going to stick around for the first couple chapters? No, that's the you know, that's the character status quo. And that's normally not as interesting as when they hit their lowest and they crawl out of it. The world. If you have a really cool magic system, you can introduce that first page of the first book and hook it's 'em. Cool enough that you go, oh yeah, I got to see more of this. Same thing with plot. If you can have a very interesting plot, but normally you need time for that to develop. World building in the very first page of your first chapter, you can hook a reader.
That's a good point. Yeah,
absolutely.
Because you can get it from the get-go. Because I wish I could find the message right now, but we had a message from somebody months ago who was saying, hey, I'm writing a new book, and for some reason they messaged us. Okay, for those people, message Jed Hearn. Go bother him.
We have not written the books yet.
You can
come
to us
authors.
From critics who provide nothing. We just hear we are cannon fodder. When you see a fantasy story of all those minions that die before you get to the book, that's us.
That's you guys.
We are the minions.
Movie makers should not go to YouTube movie critics on how to make a movie.
Denis Villeneuve, he's doing fine. Okay. Anyways, now here's my advice. So the person messaged us and they said, hey, I made this magic system years ago where there's these swords that after, it wasn't this exact, but after 10 heartbeats, you form this sword and it's basically called a shard blade. And what happened is there's these old things called some, not the heralds, but they were called this, and there were 10 of them. And they were basically saying this idea they had in their head. And then they went and found out, Stormlight Archive exists and it has that same sword magic system as them. And so when I was messaging them back, I at the time I said something along the lines of, hey, I'm sure there's some difference. I'm sure it's just like an elemental magic system. There's something that makes yours different. I know there's a lot of similarities, but Jed, what would your advice be to that person out there that goes, wait, my thing exists? Because a lot of the times you can think you have something super cool and then you find out, it's out there. And that could be really defeating. But is there a positive to that? Is there a way to go, wait a second, hold on?
Yeah, I've definitely had that demoralizing experience of like thinking that an idea I had was super original or unique. And then someone is like, oh, so it's like this thing out there. And I remember like I had that with the Thunder Heist, where it's like the story set on these sort of floating city ships where there's like thousands of boats all joined together on this monster infested sea. And it's kind of this like very industrial steampunky vibe. And then a reviewer is like, oh, it's just like the Scar in one of China Melville's books. I can't even pronounce his name. And I was like, oh, I haven't read that. I didn't even know that was like a thing.
It's like the second book of Lies of Locke Lamora.
There we go. It's like this experience is like probably going to hit you at some point when you're writing. And you have a few choices with this. Like the first choice is you can just kind of ignore it and recognize that your own unique vision and the way that characters are going through your world is going to make it feel like distinctive and unique. As long as, you know, as long as you've read widely and you're not like just pulling just from the one series that you've read and that's like the only series you've kind of had any deep connection to. I think in most cases, like people's unique voice will allow them to come up with something that does feel fresh. It's also like affirming in the sense that, okay, you know that some readers enjoy this concept, right? Like readers enjoy the concept of magical swords that do cool things and can like, you know, cut through stone or armor really easily or something like that. That's Stormlight Archive. It's also Star Wars. It's also like so many other things out there as well, right? So in a sense, there's nothing new under the sun. And it's sort of impossible to like create something that is truly fresh and original. But also like if you do get into that position where you do feel like, okay, there is someone else out there who has done this before and mine feels very similar, then it is also good motivation to maybe apply some of the layering exercises we were talking about earlier and ask yourself like, okay, how can I actually, you know, distinguish this and try to make this feel more fresh and to just have a different spin on things. But it's certainly tough because everyone wants the credit for the, you know, the unique magic system or the unique world building. And I absolutely agree. I think definitely particularly when you're like self-publishing your fantasy books, it is great to have a marketing hook like that where you're like, okay, this magic system, you've never seen it before. Like, come into the story. And usually, like, if you've done your job well, hopefully you're pulling readers in for the magic system and maybe the world building, maybe a little bit of the plot, but hopefully they're staying for the characters. And character is like, it's maybe the hardest thing to like pull a reader who doesn't know you into your story with. It's the reason why, you know, these kind of like low budget character drama movies like can be so emotionally gripping and so fantastically moving, but they like hardly make anything at the box office because it's hard to like have a hook that pulls people in the same way as, you know, oh, Come Along to June. It's like this massive sci-fi epic and there's these giant sandworms and, you know, Timothée Chalamet is going to trip out and see into the future and that sort of thing. And I'm like, okay, cool, I'm there. But you really, in my experience at least, it's like you stay in that story for the characters, you know, transformation and their change. And I'm actually like deep in the middle of this right now because I'm working on like a mammoth video on my channel about character arcs, which is probably going to be like 60 to 90 minutes long. So I've written thousands of words for this thing.
Amazing.
But like I say that in the introduction where it's like, you know, you can bring people in with cool world building and you can bring people in with cool magic, but like ultimately it's going to be the characters that will probably be the most like memorable and interesting aspect of your story if you do them right. And if you, you know, are trying to tell a story where you are having all these different elements that are, you know, relatively balanced as we were discussing before.
I definitely think the, if your goal is to get the reader emotionally attached to your story, it is, it does come from the characters. The example that Austin and I were talking about before, the reason why we've split our judgment of books. We used to have five categories. We now have six. The reason why we've split emotional impact into emotional impact and thought provokingness is because I think they are very separate sometimes that I can think and a book can get me to really think about something without making me emotionally attached. And maybe like I will be thinking about it and it really fascinating. And I really
enjoy
the book.
A lot of sci-fi's do that.
Exactly.
Probably Neuromancer is one of those for you.
Neuromancer is one of them. Fire Upon the Deep.
Those ones you're talking about that focus on world and thought. And
Hyperion does both for me, but not for you. But point being is, yeah, the if you're trying to make people care and cry, and the best way to get people to want to read more of your books is if they're emotionally attached to it, not necessarily fascinated. If someone reads your book and you're like, fascinating, will they pick up book two? No, maybe not. It's a lot easier if someone is like dying to know what happens to this character. So yeah, no, you are right. If you're trying to get people to read, love your work, it's vastly important to get them to care about your characters.
Yeah, that's characters being a whole nother subject of this, of a lot of authors who do focus on character first and then kind of trickle and make their world out of something, because there's your more, maybe your pantsers do this more, because of the two kind of categories, Jed, you obviously know this, of your pantser versus plotter. Do you ascribe by those two general categories of authors?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think it's definitely a spectrum. I'm certainly way more on the outlining side of that spectrum.
Great, yeah, because for audiences that know, just pantsers being authors that go with a character and kind of just put them into situations. And they go, Dungeon Crawl Carl is the author there, is a pantser.
He is. Pantser to the extreme.
Stephen King's the most famous pantser. He just writes down, so he'll start with the character and just make the story go somewhere. Whereas your plotters, your outliners can still be very character focused, but your plotters and outliners maybe have a more tendency to be world building focused or magic focused or care more about it, maybe, to where your Stephen King's or pantser. So maybe the type of author you are makes you more focused naturally into one thing. Doesn't one size fits all, but Jed, do you think that maybe your tendency to write a certain way? So if an author is pantsing, and again, that term just meaning they start with a character, they don't really have it plotted out and they just want to throw them in situations and the world kind of comes from there. Or am I thinking of this incorrectly and do they have it thought out but just don't know exactly the plot points? How would you distinguish that pantser from plotter and how they craft a world?
I think there's, for me, not much of a distinction. I think I can certainly see a scenario in which it's like, okay, I've spent 10 years world building this thing, I'm gonna just throw a character at it and see like where she goes. I feel like that would be a totally logical way to approach it as a pantser. Certainly as an outliner, you know, you probably do have more of a natural tendency to be doing a lot of development work before you begin writing the first draft. And a lot of that development work is probably going to look like, okay, I want to figure out, you know, what is the city that this story is taking place in and why did it spring up here and what's the religion that has developed around it and that sort of thing. So I don't think that either category is necessarily more world-building oriented. In fact, I don't know. I don't really feel like either one has like a real claim on they do more world-building than the other person. It could just depend where in the process they do the world-building perhaps. Like, you know, maybe the outliner is probably doing a lot more world-building prior to the story beginning, but even as someone who outlines a lot in Kingdom of Dragons, a lot of my world-building came like after the first draft. Like there's a whole sequence where a character is kind of going through these visions in this sort of ancient amulet. And in the first draft, I literally just had, every time I had one of those vision chapters, it was like dialogue between my main character and his sort of mentor in there. And then I just left like everything else blank. And it was only in the third draft that I actually went back through. And I was like, okay, now I'm actually going to like, now that I know that there's like five of these scenes scattered throughout the story, I'm going to figure out like an interesting historical part of the world to be showing in these visions. And then I wrote that like kind of separately, almost like a different novella, I suppose. So that's an example of like the world building coming a lot later in the process, but still hopefully when you read it, like feeling organic and cohesive to the overall story.
Fair enough. Because one of those, talking about Sanderson's, one of his other laws, we talked about one of them, which was limits versus limits more interesting than the powers themselves. But another one being expand, don't just add a bunch of world elements, expand on the ones you've already created. So maybe on this point here of, hey, whether you're a pantser or whether you're a plotter, if you take a a world element that you kind of just throw in there, maybe you planned it out and have this big world element, or maybe it just comes to you as you're writing the book and you go, okay, there's this thing that now I have this one nugget, and that one nugget, I'm going to constantly expand on this now that I came up with the idea. Even if you didn't plan this out a bunch, I will look at this nugget and I will make something of it throughout the rest of this book and book series. Yeah, how important do you guys think that is with do you agree with Sanderson's advice there of typically expanding on something you've already created is better than just adding a bunch?
Typically, yeah. I mean, as a reader more especially, it can get really jarring or kind of maybe intimidating is the right word, of you're just constantly thrown new stuff and you don't have enough time to digest what you've already been given.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes that can be good. Like sometimes I like a book that just kind of throws me in the deep end and I'm like, oh, Lord, that's a lot to process. It can be fun. But often, like, you can only handle that for so long. Eventually, the book should focus on something that allows you to actually catch up and understand it. So that's, I think, the reason why you should dive deeper rather than larger.
Do you do that, Jed?
Yeah, definitely. I think a good example of this principle of like expand from what you already have actually comes in Rob J. Hayes's The War Eternal series. So Rob was explaining this to me a while ago because like we used to run a podcast together back in the day. Shout out to the Wizards, Warriors, and Words crew, if anyone remembers that show.
What, wait, hold on. When did this end? What happened? You had a podcast?
Yeah, that's right. We did about 120 episodes, I think. And then it just got to the point where like the time zones were tricky because I was in Australia, Rob was in the UK, Michael Fletcher was in Canada, and then Dirk Ashton was in the USA. So it was like, it was just all over the place.
That's impossible.
You guys are lucky because you're like right next to each other, which is awesome.
Are we?
Could just be some amazing editing. It's just Austin in a room by himself, just chatting to fake Richard over here. But yeah, he had a really, like he literally told me this. He's like, oh yeah, there's all these world building details I kind of just threw into the first book. That then when it came to books 2 and 3, I realized were actually like had way deeper layers of things that were going on. So like an example here is in the first book, he mentions how there's these two moons that orbit around the planet and the moons collided like a long time ago. And so bits of their debris are like still falling to the earth basically. And when you read it in book 1, you're like, that's a sick world building detail. Like now I'm thinking about that every time there's a nighttime scene and the characters are looking up at the two moons that are, you know, sending chunks of themselves falling down to the planet.
Sick.
But then later we find out that like, oh, those two moons kind of represented like these two ancient races of gods. And there was this war between them and the debris that's coming down, like actually contains some of their like weapons or in some instances, even like some of their bodies and that sort of thing. And it's a cool example of like, you just threw something out there and then when you were developing the other books, you looked around at the stuff you'd thrown at the wall and you realized like, oh, this bit of spaghetti is like still on the wall and it kind of looks like this thing. I'm going to, you know, take it in this particular direction. And there's multiple things in that series that he did that with. I won't, you know, spoil it too much at all because it's a very good series. But, you know, there's another thing where it's like, there's this scene in the desert where he just mentions there's a huge like gash in the fabric of space and there's like a giant eye that looks through it. In book one, it's just a cool world building detail. In book two, the character kind of gets this ability to sort of like teleport from location to location, but the way it works is you sort of open a portal into this weird nether region, you step through, and then you like step out of a portal in this other region. But the more that the main character goes through this region, she starts to kind of like feel the presence of like this eldritch entity that's in there and starts to worry that like, okay, if I keep doing this, am I like going to step out the other side or am I going to get trapped in here forever? And it's a good example of like, you start from this world building thing and then you link it into the magic. And then you're also linking it into like a restriction with the magic. And that itself is then also linking it to character because now every time she's using this ability, it's telling you something about the character because it's not a zero cost thing. It's something that has potential cost. And as a result, like you're learning a lot about what is this character willing to sacrifice or not willing to sacrifice in that scenario.
This loops us all the way back around to maybe that's the whole point with world building is if you can intersect your world with your characters, with your plot and everything makes sense. And the first thing that was mentioned was tone. You started us off with this episode of going over how important tone is, whether it's a whimsical tone, because that element that was added in Rob Hayes, is that his name? Rob Hayes' book?
Yeah, that's right. Rob J. Hayes. Yeah.
Robert J. Hayes. And where he had this moon, these gods were sending weapons down because it's expanded on that. I can already get the tone of the book from that. I can bet you the tone of that isn't funny. It's probably not going for funny because as soon as Terry Pratchett in Discworld adds the more in books, the more words you have to read in a book, the more power the book has. Is that what it is, Rich?
Yeah, no, the words on the page have power. And so libraries are just chaos.
They're so powerful. And immediately when you give that world building to it goes, oh, that's a fun, whimsical world.
Yes.
So all of your elements, when you're just like you're saying, Jed, intertwining with your character then to your plot element, when it all has a consistent tone and this coherent way of feeling, okay, that is so X fill in the blank world. That is totally what would happen there. Like Red Rising, as I got to mention every episode, got it in at the end here with a Red Rising world.
I was wondering if you were going to include this.
I have to. I absolutely have to.
Hey, I talked about Wheel of Time pretty early on. You mentioned Red Rising.
It's a complete episode now.
Exactly.
Where you can think of an element that has to do with the wars in Red Rising and go like, okay, that this theme of war, or when you think of Mercury, I'm staying light, but when you go on certain planets on Red Rising, go, okay, that makes sense in the tone of Red Rising. Or just an important tone with worlds and looping us back in with Sanderson's last law here for magic systems, worlds, etc., is an author's ability to solve conflict with magic is directly proportional to how well the reader understands said magic.
Well, so before we move on to that, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our friend here, Andrew Givler. I hope he doesn't mind. I don't think he would. He sent us over the first third of a new story he was writing. And just like, hey, what are your thoughts? Want to get our thoughts on it. And it just reminded me so much, Jed, of what you were bringing up.
This is great. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's just a cool world building element that had no idea, like further. It's just supposed to be cool in the background, no plans.
Yeah.
But after all of everyone that's read this excerpt, kept asking about that and going like, oh, that's got to be important.
For context, he has 30,000 of words of a book and he was getting feelers of, hey, what do you think? I'm going to keep writing this story. And so he sent it to people and Rich read the first 30,000 words.
I'm going to give you this.
Yeah.
It's more of it's a Roman-esque fantasy setting.
Mm-hmm.
And as they described it is the character looks up and sees, you know, the night sky, the moon and the stars. And then also going across the sky is the island of Mount Olympus that's actually real. And as they described, is the empty halls of Mount Olympus. When they sent the Iron Legion up there, they found all the gods dead.
That's cool.
What? I want to know more. Excuse me? So many questions.
And the best part is Andrew's like, oh yeah, that was just an aside thing. I wasn't expanding on that. And yeah, all of his beta readers are like, are you kidding me?
That's the story, yeah, man.
You can't leave that there and expect us to move on.
Yes.
But exactly that point of he was kind of just put this little element there, and then all of a sudden it's going to expand it more and
it's
more.
It's now
and
a nugget
more
that he's going to have to expand on. Yeah.
And that, yep, that whole book, I think that goes in his last law of the ability to solve conflict with magic directly proportional to how well the reader understands that magic, of getting to that point of how well you understand your world and your setting, how coherent is it? And even that little nugget there of putting the island of Mount Olympus, that is, I want to read that book so bad.
I know.
So bad. If you just, these little nuggets, and then the more you can help your reader, I mean, it's essential. Your reader has to, as much as they can confuse you with 1,000 different things and throw at you, as much as you like being confused at first, if you can ground yourself at some point, and the more you understand the magic system, the more you understand the world, the better you'll get those satisfying moments that the world and the book's supposed to give you. I don't think that's too controversial, Jed. Do you agree with that as well?
I agree with that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I don't think that's a very controversial statement.
Yeah, I think understanding things
nice
is
and milk toast. Yeah.
But Jed, I think this is, do we have, I think we solved worlds. I'm trying to think if
I think we solved it.
We did answer the question, guys.
You don't need to ask any more questions now. It's set
what
up.
What was
right
the
there
question in the first place?
That's a great question.
How do you make the perfect world?
You watch this episode and
there you go.
You listen to half of it and then you'll get somewhere.
Mm-hmm. You know, listen to it in the background where you're, you know, driving, and you'll figure it all out.
That's
it's
right.
Fine. Why listen to Sanderson's lectures or read any books? But
you know, and in a way, Jed, your videos and our videos, these videos on YouTube are a little world in ourselves we're crafting.
I like that.
Oh, I thought you were going like they're the opposites of where Jed puts a lot of time, effort, and writing into getting his scripts. You could look at his thumbnails. I'm like, oh man, hours of work went into this. Mm-hmm. And then you look at Tudor Rail Podcast, go, yeah. I really hope they didn't write this, because
well,
if they did, that's pretty sad.
He's crafting a world of expectations where the thumbnails, they expect a good video because
that's true.
When they click on a thumbnail of Jed's video, they go, okay, I'm getting information. Okay, I'm getting advice. Good, good. All these things. I'm getting use out of my time.
There's a level of professionalism there that you expect.
His thumbnail is coherent with his videos because it is directed to, oh my goodness! Then
we shouldn't be improving our thumbnails.
No,
that
because then they
too
expect
high
more.
Exactly.
So we will
keep
craft
those
our
expectations
world
real low.
We will expand on our that's mediocrity. It. We will not add anymore. Wow! This.
I'm glad you guys could come to this realization.
Yeah,
it sounds like a real epiphany.
Jed, we loved having you on. This was very fun for us.
This is a blast.
Last minute for all the people watching. What do you want to share with people? Where do you want them to find you? Which book do you want them to buy first?
Man, probably the best place is like if you have enjoyed the writing advice stuff and you just want more, you know, writing tips and everything, go check out my YouTube channel. I've got a ton of videos on there about world building and developing characters and plotting your fantasy novel and quite a few on magic systems as well. I think, Austin, you mentioned the magic system contest I ran where I had about 100 writers send in their magic ideas to me and I picked my favorite one to win $1,000. That was a really fun contest to run. I'm actually, I feel like this is maybe the first place I've publicly announced it, but I'm going to be running a world building contest on there soon. So it's very appropriate that we just had this episode talking about world building because I'll be doing the same thing, hopefully with more writers, hopefully with some cool ideas as well.
You may see a little submission
a
from
Austin. Submission.
I don't know, maybe. Any one of us will send something in there.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about how to do good worlds for the last 80 minutes, so hopefully some of it rubs off in the submission. And then in terms of books, like my latest book is Kingdom of Dragons. That's in the process of sort of being printed and sent out to all my Kickstarter backers right now. So it'll be publicly available probably in a few months. But if you want to read a book that I've written right now, probably the best place to start and the place that I always recommend people to start is like The Thunder Heist. It is a heist story set on this monster-infested sea where this pirate, Kef Cutmark, comes to this city of Zoroth, this sort of floating city ship made from thousands of boats all lashed together. And in this city, she's attempting to steal a item that channels energy from lightning to power the whole city. And it's a world of alchemists and mutants and corruption and these weird societies that have been built because everyone in this world just lives on the ocean. No one can live on the lands because they're all monster infested. And so I think there's some nice world building in here. I used to be an architect before I became a full-time author and YouTuber. So this is probably the story in which I pour the most kind of like, I don't know, architectural insights or architectural world building into it, just because of how much of it takes place in these sort of urban maritime settings. And it's very fast paced. A lot of readers tell me they kind of get through it in one or two sessions sometimes, which is both amazing to hear and also a little bit demoralizing because you're like, yeah. I spent 8 months of my life writing that.
I hate to throw in another point here. Let's not expand on this, but the whole point of you having architecture background and then using it in the world building of this book, that's something else, like Tolkien, language, and actually developing language in his book. Another great thing that writers can do is something that you know in the real world, apply that to whatever your knowledge base is and expand on that.
Absolutely.
It'll look so well done because, hey, the Fire Upon the Deep, which you mentioned a bunch of times, that was done by Werner Vinge, who is the geekiest of geeks, who geeked out about the singularity and therefore had a whole thing about the singularity and had something great to say.
Oh, yeah. And Mark Lawrence is a physicist and his worlds are amazingly detailed and wonderful concepts that actually make sense with this, you know, with his scientific background. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Jed, everybody go buy Jed's book, check out his channel. We'll have links in the description below. And also Jed, just to ask you, that whole idea you have with the world building stuff of getting people to submit and talk about the worlds, things like that. Do you mind if we, steal that? we'll do something adjacent. We'll have like...
No. We're going to take it with a twist.
With a twist.
You know, Jed heard...
That's right. Add your own restrictions and limitations. We will.
Exactly. You send in Jed... you send your world over to Jed and he'll give you $1,000. You send your worlds to us, we'll give you a crisp high five.
Yeah, I like it.
I think that sounds about right.
I feel like I need to up my prizes then, if that's the case.
Oh, also, we should end the episode now, but I'll talk. Are you going to Dragonsteel at all? Are you going to Dragonsteel?
I'm not sure. I'm on the other side of the world, so I might get over there.
That makes sense. Yes. Dang, I was getting excited. Oh, okay.
It would be good fun, though, because they're like launching the fifth Stormlight book there, right?
If you get... Yeah, tickets are all sold out, so you have to find a scab if you want a ticket, though. So that'll be a lot harder.
I see.
But
okay, at some point we got to end this up. Jed, thank you so much for coming on. We'll see you all next week. Go check out Jed's stuff. Bye, everybody.
Bye, y'all.
Thanks, guys.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at gethumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.